Hello and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. This week, Mishpatim. If you apply to the Pardes Year Program before March 20th, then we'll waive your $50 application fee. So please check it out, the year program, and all the other information about Pardes is at www.pardes.org.il. We're on Twitter with the podcast, so set your Twitter machine to follow us at Pardes Podcast, and that way you'll be the first to know each week when there is a new podcast. This week, Dr. Mish Hammer Kasoy discusses Mishpatim. Dr. Mish Hammer Kasoy is a member of the faculty. Her focus is Talmud. In addition, she's the director of admissions for Pardes. And now, Dr. Mish Hammer Kasoy.
Thank you, Larry. Ilu kervanu lifnei har Sinai velo natan lanu et haTorah dayenu. It would have been enough for us had God just brought us to the mountain of Sinai, but not given us the Torah. There's this inherent in that famous line from Dayenu in the Haggadah is this idea that revelation itself, being in God's presence, is of tremendous value. But we were given the Torah, and in the core of the Torah is a covenant of law. And if last week's content to revelation, the Ten Commandments, wasn't enough, this week's revelation of law, which seems to be a direct outgrowth of the Sinai covenant, shows just to what extent Judaism is defined by our relationship to law. This week's parsha, Parshat Mishpatim, the Sefer HaChinuch, which is a famous enumerator of the mitzvot, counts that there are 23 do's and 30 don'ts in this week's parsha. Because that's a little bit overwhelming, I'm going to try just to focus on a single law this week, what the Sefer HaChinuch calls the law of fines or personal damages. And I'm going to read the verses in Exodus 21, verses 22 through 25. I'll read them in both Hebrew and English. Ki yinatsu anashim v'nagfu isha hara v'yatsu yiladeha v'lo yeh ason. When men fight and one of them pushes a pregnant woman and a miscarriage results, but no other damage ensues. Ason yanish kasher yashit alav bal haisha v'natan beflilim. The one who is responsible shall be fined according as the woman's husband may exact from him the payment to be based on the reckoning. Okay, the words are very difficult. I've read to you from the JPS translation, just the first verse. I'll read through the whole thing. Im ason yeh v'natata nefesh tachat nafesh. But if other damage ensues, the penalty shall be life for life. Ayin tachat ayin, shein tachat shein, yad tachat yad, regel tachat ragel. Eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot. Kviya tachat kviya, petza tachat patza, chabura tachat chabura. Burn for burn, wound for wound, bruise for bruise. So there's a lot of things that are confusing about these verses. The first, the most obvious, the first in the verses being there's a fight between two men, and somehow this poor woman gets involved in her yatsav ladeha velo yeh ason. She miscarriages, and the translation, the Hebrew word says velo yeh ason, and JPS here translates, but no other damage ensues. I would translate, and it is not an ason, i.e. a tragedy, as opposed to in the following verse, in that case where there's what seems to be just a miscarriage, but not a tragedy, whatever that word tragedy means, in that context, anoshi anesh, there will surely be a punishment, but the punishment is a fine, okay, who will be fined according to, we put to arbitration, v'natan b'flilim seems to mean the judges will determine how much money the assailant owes Baal Ha'isha, the husband. But then in verse 23, there's a contrast. Ima sonia. However, if there is a tragedy, Vanatata nefesh tahat nafesh. But if there is a tragedy, then you will give life for life. Which seems to imply that miscarriage is, well, that clearly implies that miscarriage is not a tragedy and that something else is a tragedy. It's not 100% clear what those things are. Jewish tradition understands that to mean that miscarriage, miscarriage and thus abortion is not a capital offense. The canon law, the Septuagint reads, the stillborn child is perfectly formed, then he shall give life for life. If imasonia means if the stillborn child is perfectly formed, but that's not the Jewish law. The Jewish law seems so just to give you a sense of how difficult the verse is by itself, that's the Christian interpretation, or certainly the Catholic interpretation of the verse, and it's been very important in canon law, whereas Jewish law understands this to be, yet the loss of the fetus is not a tragedy, whereas the loss of the woman is a tragedy. But there's another piece that's also very strange, because while the law seems to be about the contrast between loss of fetus and loss of mother, the next verse says, ein tachat ein, shein tachat shein, goes on to say, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, bruise for bruise. And we wonder, what are those verses doing there? What is the relationship between nefesh tachat nafesh and miscarriage? And how do these things all fit together? Clearly, nefesh tachat nafesh seems to mean, life for life seems to mean that if the assailant kills the woman, then he himself shall be killed. Does that also seem to imply that if he pokes out her eye, his eye will be poked out, etc.? So this verse itself is confusing. The fact that this verse, the same expression of eye for eye, tooth for tooth, is actually found in two other places in the Torah. It's found in Leviticus 24, where it actually seems to be a very straightforward articulation contrasting the damages of an ox. If an ox is killed, then you shall pay. However, if you kill a person, motumat, and then you will surely die. And then it goes on to say, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. That would be considered relatively straightforward had it not been in the context of a cursing a half-Jewish, half-Egyptian man who curses God and is in the middle of being sentenced as these verses are revealed, and that's itself a bit confusing. And then also in Deuteronomy 19, in the context of the law of conspiring witnesses, it says there that as the witnesses, so if you have conspiring witnesses, you shall asitim lo kasher zaman lasot lachiv, you will do to them as they have conspired to do to their brother, and you will don't have mercy, rather give life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, or leg for leg. So again, I'm confused what exactly I understand life for life if the witnesses were conspiring to have a witness, to have somebody executed, but I'm not sure exactly under what circumstances a witness would be conspiring to have someone's tooth knocked out and therefore would need his tooth knocked out. So we've got three cases. The common denominator of them, all of them, is this expression, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. And the first one is in our parsha this week. Biblical scholars call this lex talion, the law of reciprocity or exact equivalence. And the rabbis of the Talmud understand this verse to understand this not literally, but as a demand of financial reciprocity, that five distinct payments, damage, healing, loss of war, pain, and embarrassment, all of those things should be paid, and you should calculate each, well, specifically calculate the damage, to understand the damage, by valuing the victim on the slave market before the injury and after the injury, and whatever his loss in value, if you will, is the damage that you have to pay, and that will be considered, according to the rabbis, eye for an eye. Many people have wondered to what extent this is would be considered a strong reading of the verse, or whether this is the plain meaning of the verse. academic biblical scholars are divided. There are many biblical scholars who take this, who understood this law literally, and they looked to understand this idea of eye for an eye in comparison to the ancient Near Eastern laws, comparative law in the Near East, specifically the Hammurabi Code, which also had this idea of talion, of equivalent punishments, but they actually went beyond. The Jewish law has very simple, straightforward, local reciprocity, talion. That is to say that if I take out your eye, you take out my eye. But what if I kill your daughter? Perhaps he should kill my daughter. That's how it works in Hammurabi. And so many biblical scholars see, wow, look how advanced biblical law is, because we do not have vicarious talion. We only have direct talion. Similarly, we have eye for an eye, but only one eye for an eye, not more than eye for an eye. And it would appear on the face of it that this law is designed to, on the one hand, deter punishment, on the other, deter damage and assault, but also to limit the cycle of violence and revenge. So many biblical scholars have not seen this, have seen this literal talion as the simple reading of the text in the first place, and also, in some ways, an enlightened law, if you will. There are other biblical scholars who have accepted the rabbinic interpretation as the simple reading, as pshat, and they see this formulaic, the very fact that the law is stated, eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, in three places, as a way of saying, you get what you deserved, which is not meant to be taken literally, as you see in the case of Judges with Samson. Samson's wife and father are killed, and he goes out and kills many Philistines in reaction to that, in response to that, and he justifies his action as saying, as they did to me, so I did to them. They got what they deserved. An expression of lex talion, when it's really not a literal expression of lex talion. He doesn't do exactly what was done to them, but the same general idea. And it's possible, say biblical scholars, that also this expression, eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, which is placed in places where it doesn't belong, literally, is just a sort of catchphrase for you get what's coming to you, but which could easily have meant, even in biblical times, that you pay money in exchange for the damage that's been done to you. And that is the approach that the Talmud takes, where it insists by adducing 9 proofs. It's very insistent by bringing 9 proofs, 5 of which rely on uniquely rabbinic hermeneutical devices, analogies from words, what they call a gzera shava. It says makeh here and it says makeh there. You've got smiting in 2 places. In one case, smiting. When you smite an animal, you have to pay for it. Similarly, when you smite a person, you also have to pay for it. Similarly, in the word in place of, what you shall repay in place of an ox, so too you shall repay an eye in place of an eye, tachat, from the word tachat. Similarly, there are arguments that the words hand and natata and giving, both of which are found in our verses in Exodus, but also in Leviticus, are code for giving. They imply exchange of money. Similarly, there's a Torah statement that I haven't yet cited in Bamidbar, in Numbers, that says, you shall not take ransom for a murderer. And the minute one says, you shall not take ransom for a murderer, seems to imply that there are other things for which you can take ransom, anything less than murder, which would seem to imply that for taking off someone's arm, you can take ransom, i.e., you can take payment. The Talmud also adduces logical proofs. The fact that the Torah explicitly legislates payment to victims for healing and loss of labor seems to imply that the culprit is not enduring that same need for healing and loss. Had he been literally, had you taken out his eye in the same way that he had taken out someone else's eye, he would also need healing and he would also miss work, and therefore the playing field would have been evened and there'd be no need for him to make a payment. The fact that the Torah explicitly legislates, again, in just a few verses above, the verses that I read to you, is a sign that it's meant to be taken not literally, but as payment. This demand of eye for an eye is not to be meant to take literally. Similarly, the fact that not all people have equal arms, equal eyes, and equal teeth. Some people don't even have arms, eyes, and teeth, would seem to make lex talion, equal punishment, absolutely impossible from the beginning. And finally, and perhaps most importantly, to take out someone's eye, especially before the age of antibiotics, and to assume that you would just take out his eye and that he wouldn't endure loss of blood or infection that would eventually lead to his death, would see the impossibility of having, of precisely reproducing the punishment, reproducing the wound that he inflicted on someone else to reproduce it on him without causing something greater, very possibly would seem to also make this idea of talion being taken literally absolutely unrealistic. So we've looked at a little bit of biblical scholarship, looked at a little bit of Talmudic scholarship. The Talmud, as I said, adduces 9 proofs, some of which are actually very persuasive. However, we're left wondering, doth the lady protest too much? Does the fact that the rabbis induce proof after proof, 9 proof texts, not indicate that there's a little bit of defensiveness, a little bit of a sense that perhaps that's not the simple reading of the text? And another possible indication of that is the fact that actually the 10th proof that's given is that of Rabbi Eliezer, where he says, ayin tachat ayin mamash, that eye for an eye should be taken literally. Now, the Gemara immediately dismisses this and reinterprets it in a different way, but the very fact that there's someone out there that seems to say it should be taken literally gives us this sense that perhaps that's not the simple reading of the text and that the rabbis are very much aware of that. So we've seen so far we've seen a very difficult law. We've seen some biblical and some rabbinic exegesis in it, on it. We've also, in some ways, I think as moderns, it would be hard for us, to imagine the law any other way. It's obvious to us that it doesn't make sense to take off someone's arm after because he's taken off your arm. And although there's a lot of scholarship on this law, I'd like to suggest that it's somewhat tendential, that it's all designed to prove just how enlightened the Torah was. Either the Torah itself, though even those who take it literally, the law literally, are perhaps they have an agenda to prove that the Torah is primitive. And in some cases, they have an agenda to show that it may have seemed primitive, but not as primitive as those other cultures around them. Those scholars who understand it, even in its simple Torah reading, to be talking about money, are interested in showing how enlightened the Torah was. And some people, and the scholars who don't read it that way, are interested in showing how even more enlightened the rabbis were. Or alternatively, how the rabbis take a primitive text and are able to reinterpret, dynamically innovate, and keep Judaism relevant, even in the face of primitive texts. That shows just how vibrant our religion is. And all of those things may be true at some various level. But for me, perhaps what's more important is to understand if the simple reading of the text, or if we're to understand the text, as the rabbis do, and certainly as all of us are interested in doing, as monetary compensation, then why doesn't the Torah just say explicitly, give money? Why does the Torah say eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, in a way that's so easily interpreted to mean literally, or mamash? I'd like to share just a couple of ideas on this before I close. The first is the suggestion that emerges from a very famous essay of Rav Soloveitchik that he composed in 1956 on the 8th anniversary of the State of Israel, where he is arguing for the State of Israel as a sign of divine providence. In that context, he adduces six proofs, what he sees as six knocks. He calls six knocks, or calls from God. That's the birth of the State of Israel is a sign of divine providence. And in that context, the fifth of those knocks, says Rav Soloveitchik, has to do with this idea of ayin tachat ayin, an eye for an eye. So I will recite for you from that. The fifth knock of the beloved, that is God, is perhaps the most important. For the first time in the annals of our exile, divine providence has amazed our enemies with the astounding discovery that Jewish blood is not cheap. If the anti-Semites describe this phenomenon as being an eye for an eye, we will agree with them. If we want to courageously defend our continued national and historical existence, we must, from time to time, interpret the verse of an eye for an eye literally. So many eyes were lost in the course of our bitter exile because we did not repay hurt for hurt. The time has come for us to fulfill the simple meaning of an eye for an eye. Of course, I am sure everyone recognizes that I am an adherent of the oral law, and from my perspective, there is no doubt that the verse refers to monetary restitution, as defined by the halakha. However, with respect to Mufti and Nasser, I would demand that we interpret the verse in accordance with its literal meaning, the taking of an actual eye. And I'm skipping near the end. A people that cannot defend its freedom and tranquility is neither free nor independent. The third of the phrases of the divine redemption is, "And I shall redeem you with an outstretched hand and with great judgments." Thank God we have lived to see the day when, with the help of God, Jews have it within their power to defend themselves. In this moving passage, which in its larger context is even more moving, Rav Soloveitchik is arguing that the simple reading of the text really does endure together with its halachic meaning. The pshat and the drash, the pshat and the drash coexist. In the simple reading, eye for an eye literally, in this context, functions, if you will, as the drash, as a moral statement. Some people need to know that we have the right to preserve ourselves in self-defense. That if you kill Jews and then the Jews see fit to kill you in actuality, in that context, you deserve it. There's a time to be primitive, says Rav Soloveitchik, and there's no need to apologize for it. In some ways, I think that Rabbi Eliezer, I mentioned already before that Rabbi Eliezer in the Gemara, the Tana in the second century, also suggested that eye for an eye should be taken literally, and perhaps the Gemara understands him in a way that has some connections with that of Rav Soloveitchik. The Gemara objects. Rabbi Eliezer, when he says eye for an eye is to be taken literally, he couldn't possibly be disagreeing with all nine arguments that have already been advanced above. How could he possibly refute all of those arguments? Rather, surely, he meant that instead of valuing the victim as a slave, remember we had said that that when you're assessing damages, you figure out how much was the worth of the victim reduced on the slave market. Rather interprets the Gemara, Rabbi Eliezer, we value the perpetrator with and without an eye. Meaning, now instead of figuring out how much the victim's value has been reduced, we imagine how much would the perpetrator's value be reduced if we would take out his eye. And the Gemara offers this up as an interpretation of Rabbi Eliezer's suggestion that an eye for an eye is to be taken literally. While I don't think that that is a simple reading of Rabbi Eliezer, I think it a little bit captures the idea that perhaps is behind or does give us an understanding of how we could understand an eye for an eye literally. And the Rambam, I think, suggests something different, something similar. He suggests that the Torah says, do not take ransom for, as I've said before, do not take ransom for the life of a murderer. For the murderer, you do not take a ransom, but you do take ransom for physical damages. And the goal is that you should know that you deserved to have your limb taken off, says the Rambam. Ra'ui l'chasro ever o lichbo bo kamo she'asa. The reason why we value the victim, the perpetrator, and we see how much his worth has gone down is because he should understand that what he really deserves to happen to him is have his eye taken out. But although we're not going to do that, we want him to understand that that is what he deserves, that money is not really a sufficient punishment for the crime that he has perpetrated. And that seems to me very much to, I'd like to close with the idea of Moshe Greenberg, who is a biblical scholar at Hebrew University, who suggests, in general, he wrote a seminal article called Postulates of Criminal Law, where he makes a general argument that the biblical law, one thing that makes biblical law unique compared to other ancient Near Eastern texts, is this very clear distinction between life, human life, and property. Unlike other ancient laws, whenever there's a loss of life involved, the punishment will always be capital. And there's no way that you can compensate for the loss of a human life with money. And conversely, when there's a property crime, it will never be punished in Jewish law by the loss of life. There's no such thing as a property offense, which will involve a property offense will always be punished with a payment and never be punished with loss of life. And so that even if the court doesn't actually punish you capitally for a capital crime, the line will never be blurred. There'll be no pretense that you can make a payment for that loss of life. There's no, life is life and it's priceless and you cannot put a price tag on it. That, says Moshe Greenberg, is what characterizes this week's Parsha as well as the criminal code as a whole. And I'd like to suggest that perhaps this idea of eye for an eye is the Torah expressing a deep ambivalence or some kind of anxiety about how to characterize personal injury. Because in some ways, it's neither as precious as life, but nor is it mere property. What is an eye? The Mishnah mandates that you value the individual as a slave to figure out how much you owe. But when you take the value of a person as a slave, certainly you do not account for the value of his ability to watch a sunset or her ability to rejoice as her child scores a soccer goal or stands under the chuppah. An eye is something much more than its value on a slave. And so on the one hand, life without an arm is very much still a life. But the quality of life provided by an eye or a leg or even a tooth may be something that we or insurance companies we might put a price tag on it, but ultimately it too is priceless. And that is what's being expressed in this idea, eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. Although we have you pay, what you really deserve is to have your eye taken out because there's no way to repay. Don't fool yourself into thinking for a moment, says the Torah, that you've paid and taken care of things. You've paid your debt to society. No, you can't possibly pay your debt to society with money because what you've taken away from that other individual is something truly priceless. So to summarize what we've done so far, we raised the question of the law of talion as it occurs in our Parsha and also in two other places. And we saw that biblical scholars and rabbinical scholars, both of them, argue about how those laws should be understood, whether they should be understood literally or as financial payment. We accepted the rabbinic reading of financial payment, but we also tried to understand what was the Torah trying to gain through the Torah's choice of confusing language. Say something that could have been taken literally. In answer to that question, we looked at three answers. The answer of Rav Soloveitchik, Rabbi Eliezer, the Tana in the Gemara, and Moshe Greenberg, the modern biblical scholar, all of which I think share this common denominator of we may take money, but what you really deserve is something much more, and understanding the pricelessness of the human body, that although we put money, a price tag on it, the price does not encompass the true worth or the true pain that is endured in the context of personal injury. So my prayer for each of us over this Shabbat is that we should find a way to appreciate this priceless gift of our bodies while it's still intact, and to let that appreciation infect our lives and everything we do. Shabbat Shalom.
Thanks very much, Dr. Hammer Kassoy. And thank you for tuning in to Pardes from Jerusalem.